I'm Kathleen.
And I'm Dee.
And you're listening to Mamas with Attitude, otherwise known as MWA.
Mama.
Interesting, cool, South African, relevant content.
Yeah.
On where we were at. Mm-hmm.
You know, motherhood just comes to take on its different shapes and forms.
Mama's a bounce.
Jesus.
Weird. Yeah.
You're in another zone, but you're totally out of the twilight.
Mama. Attitude.
Hey, and welcome back to MWA. We're so excited to be here because I think, Dee, this is the first episode that we've done where you are not preggers.
Amazing.
How are you feeling?
I'm exhausted. I also have a four-year-old at a window, trying to open the window to get inside the room that I'm in. And now he's pointing to the, what do you call that handle thing? He's like, open.
Now can you see the window so I can see?
Okay.
Hi, Tawi. Yo, babes. It's like, I think that this is an analogy for mothering, actually. Like, these kids come out of our womb and are desperate to just get back in any by any way or any means necessary. So I hear you. It sounds like things are busy on your end. How has Tao acclimatized to Zawi?
He's been fine. Mostly very sweet and very gentle. And he does this really funny, it's like really high pitched around us. So he goes, "Hi, Zawi Rainbow. Hi, Zawi." And it's really funny. He does it every single time. So, but he's so chuffed with his life. And then he also says really bizarre things like, "I don't need to brush my teeth because I'm a big brother now."
Amazing. And he is right. Well, not about that.
I don't know where this logic emerges from, but those are some of the things that we're dealing with. Yeah, it's been wild, but it's been incredibly beautiful. I think it's been a really special time.
Yeah.
I was telling a friend today that it feels like it's been a very healing time for me, considering what pregnancy and postpartum, early postpartum life was like for me with Tao. And I think that's been really nice, you know. So, yeah, just like a wild time, trying to obviously do way too much. But I think that really is also just how it is when there's more than one. And people had said that before and I didn't understand it. And I kind of have a little bit more of an inkling of it now. So,
I think
it's
absolutely wonderful. It's been wonderful to watch you as well from afar. Well, not that far, but from afar.
Yeah.
It does seem like, I mean, it is busy and frantic and all the rest, but it, as you said, it's been such a wonderfully magical time, actually.
Yeah.
And I'm very grateful that she's out in the world and in the most beautiful way possible, right? So, exactly. Yeah.
Perfect. And you, how are you?
Absolutely fine. Things have been busy, but I think for everyone, and really feeling like we're amping up towards the end of the year, only hopefully to ramp down. So it's been really like just quite like full on days, really long working hours, fairly consistent in terms of just like thinking through and actually taking care of myself. So like doing like really nice workouts, which has been amazing. Fairly consistently. And yeah, it's been good actually, all in all. Yeah, there's no real news actually. How sad is that?
How sad. Okay. So I think that there's always a lot that you and I have to speak about actually. But I think seeing that we've both been so succinct in our descriptions of our current lives, I think I am going to move on to introducing our guest, who we are incredibly excited to have on MWA. I'm also as excited to read her bio out to you all, which had me in chuckles. So today we have Charlene Khan on MWA. And I'm going to read this, which is, she's written in the first person, and I hope you don't mind, Charlene. She has also sent me her very snazzy.
Professional.
Yes, very snazzy.
Professional. Yes.
The one maybe when she's invited to very places. And she's, yeah, so I have all of that, but I'm actually not going to do any of that. I'm going to read what Charlene has sent as she's written it. My major love is literature, African literature, sci-fi, crime fiction, Nordic and Japanese, and fantasy. Oh, she says, sorry, I started that incorrectly. So she says, here's my bio and CV. And she says, what these don't say is my major love is literature. And then she says, they also don't say that I have oodles of useless popular culture knowledge. She does. I've seen her present on many things, and she ad-libs just like that. She's a huge Jane Austen fan. I cry during soppy romance movies and any movie where the dog dies.
I love that.
She says, I was never smart enough to be a nerd. She's lying. More of a geek, but I do cream myself occasionally over good theory.
Babe, this had me in stitches. I totally, totally resonate. And when I said I do cream, I had to read it twice. I was like, this is amazing.
Lemon cream? What?
No, girl. I knew.
You're so sweet, Dee.
She says, I waver between having diehard positions and having faith in nothing, including that everything we do means so much and absolutely nothing at all in the greater scheme of life. Ain't that the truth? I'm very interested in narrative as method, which I think is it's so wonderful that you've said that, yeah. Charlotte. I think it's so much of what we do in this podcast, right?
Yeah.
She's interested in camera and how it is a form of testimony, a fixer, a framer, a violator that can be used in dialogues where subalterns can speak without interlocutors, in education as liberator, oppressor, and mimesis. I love and hate sewing as a form of femininity and tactility. I hope you'll speak to this when we speak about when the moon waxes red, Charles. I love fashion. I have body issues still. I feel stuck at 12 and 16 years of age on alternate days and yet have a very assured sense of self, paradoxically. I love gesture and gesturing, and no one can make more mockery of myself than me. So I think that's just
beautiful. Incredible.
Beautiful, yeah. And just to say a little bit about the who is Charlene, the one on the one that gets invited to the fancy presentations. Charlene Khan is a South African visual artist, and she works in multimedia installations and performances which focus on the socio-political realities of post-apartheid and the intersectionality of race, gender, and class. And that's massive. And again, I hope we get to touch on that a little bit as well, because it comes out so powerfully in all your work, Charlene. So thank you for making the time and welcome. And I hope you enjoy this little bit of time with us.
You know, if I knew you were going to read that bio out, I would have given it more thought.
I'm grateful that you didn't. I'm grateful that you didn't.
I'm glad you didn't. I giggled all the way through. Thank you. That's why I didn't tell you that I was going to read it. I was like, if she doesn't know.
But also, sorry, just to say, just to interject before you go further into the introduction, and Charlene, before you speak, is also to say that you're the co-convener of AFIMS, the conference.
Yes, of course.
And I think that that's massive as well. Yes. So just to say, like, thank you for that space.
Co-founder.
Yeah. Amazing. Yeah. So thank you for holding that space and putting that space together for others to be held. It's incredible.
Sure. Thank you very much for this invitation to speak to the brilliance of both you, Kathleen, and Dee. It's really an honor.
Yeah. Thank you, Charles. Okay, so I am going to do a little bit of an intro as to what we're doing today. So, Charlene, one of the many reasons why we wanted to have this chat with you was to speak more broadly. And I know that in your work, you you speak as a Black feminist. I've encountered your work in a host of ways, both theory and artwork. I've seen how you teach. I've seen how moved students and audiences have been by your, by how you speak and how passionately you speak. And so when Kath and I spoke about where do we want to move to next, right? Like, which way do we want for the podcast to move next? We spoke a lot about the project of mothering, right? So in other words, thinking about what does it mean to practice care in this way that is often associated with motherhood or with mothering in a way where that is a, it's a personification of a woman who has birthed another person, right? And we know that that work is broader than that. It's bigger than that. And certainly feminist work speaks a lot to larger projects of mothering. Mm. And so I wondered if you maybe wanted to speak a little bit to what that means to you. Where does the thinking or practice of care, either as mothering or not as mothering, where does that land for you? Yeah, so maybe just to open up generally with something like that.
Mm.
If that makes any sense, I can keep talking.
Mm. Well, I had a mother, so that's where that starts from.
Yes.
I was fortunate enough to have a lot of other mothers. Mm. And, you know, in terms of my older sisters, in terms of aunts, and incredibly fortunate in terms of academic mothers. And those played a vital role in terms of me becoming a visual artist.
Mm.
And I singularly would not have become a visual artist and an academic had it not been for the woman who stepped in. Mm. You know, because I had a really good art teacher, and he was somebody who was a visual artist, and you know, he helped get me. He believed that I was meant to be an artist. Mm. And he stood up to my mother in a way, in that brief second in which her vision failed for me, because my mother had wanted me to go into the sciences, you know, because she had wanted to be a nurse. My mother only had standard 3 education. Mm-hmm. And when my second sister fell pregnant at the age of 16, and we'll discuss this a bit more, because, you know, my mother and I ended up taking care of both my sister's children since the time I was 12 years old. And so, you know, my mother basically was trying to live out her dream through me following in the sciences, of possibly becoming a radiologist. I finally settled on microbiology. So in some way, she was hoping that I would go into the sciences. Mm. And so when I then decided I wanted to become an artist, my mother was just devastated that I was pursuing this thing.
Wow.
And so my high school teacher was like, you are meant to be an artist. This is what you are meant to be. And, you know, he took me for the interview at university. It got me the interview. And it was one of my male cousins who called my mother up and said to her, "Do you remember this prophecy that was given to you when this child was born?" And there was a prophecy that when I was born that told my mother, when she decides what she wants to be, you are not to stand in her way.
Sure.
Wow.
And so my mother then remembers this, and she just, you know, because she hadn't spoken to me for 3 days when I decided mm-hmm. this. Oh. And then my mother completely changes. But from that point onwards, you know, my teacher leaves my world, and the next person who comes into my world is my lecturer, and she just returned from the UK the year before, and she's she doesn't have any children. She's a very weird person in the department. And she becomes my mentor till this very day. So for 25 years, she's been mentoring me. And she introduces me to somebody else who also, when she, you know, when she moves away to India, this person has now been mentoring me as well for over 20 years. So if you don't have anyone who's a visual artist or who are academics and stuff, these are the people who stand in the gap for you, who help you to build a vision for yourself. You know, when you don't have people in your family who, if you're the first person to go to university in your family, they are the people who stand in the gap with you, you know, who tell you how to fill in a bursary application, who tell you how to set up a portfolio, who are at the end of your degree are going, are you not going to do a master's? Who sit you down and say, what are you doing? You're spending all your time chasing boys. Is this the way you want to go in your life? and I really was chasing boys. So,
were you chasing boys or were they chasing you? Let's be honest.
I really was chasing them.
Okay.
I missed a whole semester of Greek philosophy because I was chasing them.
Oh, wow. Can I have her first word?
Yeah? What was it?
She like, she wants it. That's funny, but she doesn't even know how to talk. Mom, today, that I gave her a really big hug and made me very sad.
Oh.
But then, so today, I'm not going to do that unless the baby isn't here.
Good guy.
Charlene, do you want to speak a little bit about your mom in When the Moon Waxes Red? Your mother's role is central, right? Mm. Do you want to speak a little bit about how you come to do that work? It's a big question, but I've watched it a few times. I've cried in parts. I've sat there completely like in awe, in shock. Do you know what I mean? Like there's so many emotions that come through in the video because you're speaking in narrative. You're speaking about real things that happened to you, to your mother, to your siblings. So I'm curious to know how that work comes to life. Keep, you know, bearing in mind what you just said, right? That you had. You had a mother, of course. And for our listeners, Charlene, if you don't mind, Charlene is speaking in the past tense because her mother has passed. Although I believe you still have a mother. How, through the When the Moon Waxes Red, how do you think about, how do you get to that point where you're able to take that memory, those memories, those feelings as a child, and translate them into, put them into your work. I know, I'm sure it's not as separate as I'm making it sound, but I feel like that must have something to do with also your relationship to your mother and how you think about it.
So, yeah, I also just want to finish with the last question, Dee, because I think what, you know, the way you phrased it as the project of mothering is so important because for me, when you say that, you know, what mothers do, whether they are, you know, biological mothers, whether they are adoptive mothers, whether they are other mothers, it is a world-building exercise, you know, and feminists speak about that, world-building, world-creating, world-making. That's what mothers do, and, you know, and artists understand that, right?
Yeah.
You take what seems to be nothing to other people's eyes, and you create something all around that, and you create almost magic out of that. Mm-hmm. We do that all the time. That's what creativity is, and that's what mothers are constantly doing. they take this bundle of something and they just are constantly making a decent human being. No matter what happens, they constantly are concentrating on your potential, on your goodness, on your humanness. Yeah. And they are always just focusing, even when you're not able to see that within yourself. That's what mothers do. And it sounds so simple, but when you're a mother and you're tired and you're frustrated and you're so hurtful, and at the same time when you see how mothers respond, that's where the real magic is, you know. That's what world building is. It's not the absence of all the negativity, it's not all the absence of that crap, but it's the refusal to give into that and focus on the potential and the hope that is there. And that's massive in a time like this, right? When the world seems like it's in this devastating place that it is, that we always focus on what the potential is and what is good and sane and decent and all of that that is there. So returning to your other question, you know, that's something, you know, that defines my mother, right? My mother had like the most unbelievable life. You know, she grew up, you know, her own mother was illiterate. Her father was a philanderer. He was alcoholic. He was abusive. He was uncaring to them, and she had a very wonderful, loving mother. And so she grows up in a life of poverty because of this father. With seven other siblings, out of 11 children, you know, four with the others passing away. She's the eldest of the seven. She has to take care of all of the younger siblings, including the youngest, who are twins. By the time she's standard three, she has to give up schooling, which she absolutely loves. It's her only sort of, you know, the only space in which, you know, she can be herself. She's intelligent. She's good at sports. She's good at art. But that's the one thing she has to give up. And she's devastated when she has to do this, right? Even though it's clear that the other kids at school make fun of her, she's every day is a struggle for food in her family, and her and the other brother having to give up their food for the other younger children, making money, and the kinds of even abuses that come along, from having to go to other people's houses and work in order to get monies for food and stuff. And then at 13 years old, she's given away to this much older man to whom her father owes a gambling debt. And for the next 22 years, she's beaten every weekend when he returns from wherever he is. He damages her brain. He breaks her arm, her leg. There's one Christmas she misses because she's unconscious in the hospital. And so she has this, you know, she has this devastating history with this man. When my father finally convinces her, and my two older sisters are from this stepfather of mine, my younger brother and I from this other, my dad, my father finally convinces her to divorce him because, you know, in the 80s, nobody ever divorced. The shame and everything. And she was all constantly sent back by her brothers and stuff to him. And she had no economic means whatsoever to leave. So it's only after my father manages to convince her to leave. But of course, my father had chemical imbalance, and he starts beating her up. And so And so, you know, she then suffers with the shame because now she can't admit to anyone else that this is happening now for the second time. And this is now a love relationship as well, right? Yeah. It's not happening as consistently with my stepfather, but it's only when my dad goes into this blinding rage. But the hallmark with my mom was that despite everything thrown her way, I still don't get it, right? But she was goodness and kindness personified, and she had an incredible sense of humor. And she and her brothers all grew up with a remarkable sense of being storytellers. And so they would sit together, and they would all be sitting around each other, they would tell all these stories of going to school and the hardships and stuff. So what you hear me in this video love letter,
yes,
is literally me just telling you the stories in the way my mother told them.
Wow.
It's not even much of my creativity on my part, because it's really just me telling it in my voice. Yes. But we just grew up with, it was so visceral, the stories. I was just transported in time and space to the moment when these things happened. And so from 2009, you know, I always realized there was a project there. So from 2009, I started collecting these stories. I just didn't know how to escape the kind of Indian stereotypes that I'd been like trying to run away from my whole life, you know, the samosa selling shopkeeper, lower class Indian with the bad accent, and you know, the tooth gap one that you always see on the TV. Anytime a reporter comes around, they find that one with the tooth gap. do you know it? Because they do this with the coloreds as well, right?
They do it with the coloreds. That's why I'm laughing.
And it doesn't matter, even if they went to the University of Cape Town, they would find the colored line. So it was like, I just didn't know how to escape these things, right? The Hindu gods and goddesses and all of that. And so the Guptas and the Gandhis, everything. And then you know, that's on the one side, right? The stereotypes outside the community. And then on the other hand is all this, you know, when the community reacts against this stereotype, they become overly sentimental. Mm-hmm. They're like, we're not like that. So they become like overly romanticized and overly sentimental about themselves. And so you can't shame your own community and you can't really discuss all the, what can you say? The underbelly of the community. You can't discuss the violence that is within the community, the abuses that are going on. You can't tell truths. Yeah. And so
yeah,
I didn't know how to speak truths that were happening without feeling like I was betraying my community. And so it was only when, I mean, I'd done a number of video artworks before this, but it was when I came to Mariama Ba's So Long a Letter that I felt like I'd found real inspiration in that, in the way she's writing to her friend of the way she's been betrayed by her husband, her family, community structures. And then I was like, this could work as a video love letter, writing to my mom. And by writing to my mom, I could write to my grandmother, I could tell her a story, I could write to my sisters, I could write to my niece. Yeah. And by telling their story, I could invite other women and other mothers and other migrant stories to perhaps come and identify with our other story. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't a betrayal of our community, it was a very personal story that I was saying. And it was extending an invitation, you know, in the sense that Nikki Giovanni talks about the particular extending into the universal, and so that's really the crux of it, you know, was really was really trying to capture my mother's story and because the video work is just one part of it, right? Because it's an entire installation.
Yeah.
It was about what started it was my mother telling me about the fact that my grandmother made lace. And I didn't even know you could make lace by hand. Yeah. So the fact that here's my illiterate grandmother sewing lace with just needle and cotton. And my mother started describing it. And, you know, I'm a very visual person. Mm. So if you're telling me, you're having sex, I'll just instantly be imagining it. So immediately this image of my grandmother sitting there sewing this lace came into my head. And that really started the project. And so I went out and I started researching handmade lace. And I was like, but how did my grandmother know about how to make handmade lace? Then I discovered about how Venice, the Venetian trade of skill of handmade lace moved to India in the 1700s and how that became the start of a commercial industry which became the industry that we know as women's industry, you know, the ways in which commercial garment making is done. You know, this woman works on this part, this pocket, this woman works on this leg. So they don't even allow only one woman is tasked to put everything together because they don't want all the women to know how to make everything because they're scared that the woman will steal their stuff. So all of that was pioneered in through the lace making in India.
Wow.
And then it was taken over in China with the mechanization industry thereafter. So it became also tracing then a larger phenomenon of lace making and capitalist production in the garment industry and then it became about how, you know, migrant women, the kinds of skills that they have, how they carry those skills and that knowledge base with them, mm-hmm. and speaking to agency and how women they go through to sustain themselves and their families. And just the project just became about choosing to read across the grain, whether it was choosing to read suicide across the grain, all the stories about women killing and burning themselves, mothers choosing to kill themselves and leave children. How could that be read in another way? How could illiterate women and working in these you know, cleaning graves be read in another way?
Mm.
So it was just constantly trying to find agency in lower class, working class lives,
sure.
where there was silence around it.
Sure. I hear that.
Imprinted. Opened it. Say it again.
Imprinted.
Opened it. Say.
Must we opened it, Papa? Opened it.
Opened it.
Charlene, you've already touched on the lace and the stitching and the, but I, for those who, I mean, I want to say we'll put up some of these links and stuff either on Instagram and also just make it available so people can see what you're talking about. But I mean, the meticulous nature of sitting through that stitching, I remember seeing you do it and being like, what? How, you know, just painful. Yeah, I mean, and really, I mean, you know, one must literally sit through the tedium of it, you know. So I think it's incredible. But I wanted to touch on, Kat, maybe is there anything you want to jump in on?
Well, I just wanted to say that the sitting through the tedium around stitching is much like mothering, right? Where you sit through the tedium of the everyday, and so much of it is actually quite monotonous and tedious in this kind of hope. And I really loved, Charlene, what you were saying around that's what mothering is. It's this kind of magical exercise of world building. You called it world building. And I just... So while the outcome and moments can be magical, actually a lot of it, and likening it to the work that artists do, is actually a skill and a discipline and a showing up every day, and really sitting through, as you say, Dee, the tedium of it all, with the expectation that the outcome will be a specific thing, but also not holding onto that expectation too tightly, because we also know that the nature of work and working on something is that you give it what you can, and really it becomes its own thing. And that too is just, is incredibly fragile, you know?
Yeah,
but you're not allowed to say that, right? All of these things. You're not allowed to say mothering is tedious.
No, you're not.
You're not allowed to say that mothering is tiring. You're not allowed to say that sometimes I really don't like my children very much.
Absolutely.
You're not allowed to say I like this one more than that one.
You're not allowed to say those things. And I think I think that that's part of the reason why we started this, Charlene, is really just to start having a little bit more hard conversations, right? Like those sorts of things, that exactly what you're saying. Like, I don't like all of this, actually. And sometimes I like it even less for a lengthy period of time, where you ask yourself, have I made the right decision to embark on this project? And you can feel that way. You can't wish them away. They can't go away. Mm. They're very much present and around. And it's just,
So one of the, speaking about the present and about the what you're not allowed to say, I feel like I want to come back to this idea of narrative as method. And I'm looking at the book, Charlene, for When the Moon Waxes Red. And there's just a bit that I want to quote, and it's, how do we speak of ourselves and represent the interwoven, textured, colored narratives which are our lives? How do we pull ourselves from the four corners that a racialized wind has sent us on to, quote, re-member our fractured selves and our histories, as bell hooks does, to acknowledge this act as an invention inspired by real events, a biomythography, as Audre Lorde calls it, which remembers a general outline of an incident, the details of which are different for each of us. And I just think, for me, that there are many moments in this book that were very touching for me. But in thinking about speaking with you today about this larger project of mothering, you know, I feel like a lot of what gets done in the project of mothering is piecing together this narrative of, and then of course, as you said, Charlene, the action, the doing, the world building magic that happens from nothing, right? From the tedium. But it's also, interestingly, with a little bit of distance, you forget. So in order to like remember anything, you have to piece together a narrative that is yours. But it doesn't mean that that's the narrative that is theirs, right? Whether your children's or your partner or your extended family or a best friend. So, and what you're saying about When the Moon Waxes Red, and how you're saying this story wasn't kind of outing the community, or you're saying this was my story. This was my story. This was my mother's story. I wanted to bring this to life. I feel like what you're also saying is that this is my, you know, you're saying this is how her and her brothers spoke about things and incidents that they remembered, real life things, but you're also saying this is your memory of it. And I think that in this narration of a narration, I think there's something really valuable and powerful there, speaking about mothering, because of this notion of forgetting. So much of the doing is about doing in the present. And you, when you then do reflect back, whenever you do, you know, it's different. It's something that you've created. It's a narrative, which I find really fascinating, because then, as you're saying about having had academic mothers, mothers along the way, mothers are all around us, essentially. And each part of your life is like a narrative in and of itself. I find that really interesting. I'm just thinking about how this notion of narrative and memory comes together. But also that there's a lot of sadness here, you know, not that I'm wanting us to like go down this path of normalizing Black pain again, but I think, I think it's just an interesting point to kind of pause at. Yeah, I don't know if you want to say anything about that. I've kind of gone on a bit of a ramble. But I think there are a few things that have come up based on what you've said that I find really interesting.
Really lots of food for thought there, Dee. I mean, there is lots of sadness, you know. I mean, there's deep regret on my part. I mean, my mother struggled till she passed away. So in the last 2 years of her life, she was diagnosed with kidney disorder, and so I'm Christian. Mm-hmm. I always have been, and my mother, and that came from my mother. My father was Muslim, and I don't want my dad to come across as a bad person. I mean, so much of who I am, including a feminist, comes from my dad. This you know, unequivocal voice, this hectic stance that I have, is all from him. And I think that's the disclaimer I want to give for when the for this video. And I set it up with the understanding that I knew he was going to be the bad guy.
Sure.
But this I needed this feminist video to have a story arc, and in good story arcs there needs to be a bad guy.
Yeah.
and I was okay with him being the fall guy. I was okay with that, because their stories were so important that I thought it was okay for him to be sacrificed in that narrative. Even as now, I think, you know, I wonder if there's a way to, you know, if there's another part to this work, a different work, where there's a work about mental health and my dad, where he gets to be recuperated in other ways.
Yes.
In his own story. Mm. But that's something separate. This work is I'm okay with that. You know, and I remember when she was diagnosed, her diagnosis came in that same week. He was in the hospital, and he died very, it was a shock, right? Mm. He went in, he had to change that box in his throat, because you know, he had that, I can't remember what it's called now.
The larynx.
So that little voice box in that throat.
Isn't it the larynx? Yeah.
You'll have to. I'm going with what you're saying.
Okay.
My brain is not working now.
Were they together at that stage still?
Yes. Okay. So at one point, the film does discuss it. I stood up to my dad, and I told him that, you know, there was no way I'm allowing, you know, this kind of thing to continue, and it stopped in my family, the kind of physical violence. But we never spoke for 2 years, which was very difficult for me. And we did reconcile with my mother asking me to. But this is how much my dad loved me, that he was willing to stop everything in order to have his daughter back.
How old were you at that time, Charlene?
This was in my 30s. So this was I think I was around 32. when this happened.
Okay.
It was very so he goes under this operation, and he comes home. He has lost his voice because something was wrong with the operation, and his vocal cords are swollen, and he goes to bed. I hear him going to bed. I go to the bathroom. I come back out. I realize I can't hear that pipe. I go to the room. He's passed away in 15 minutes time. So it was incredibly traumatic. And my mom is in the hospital. Well, my mom just came home from the hospital. She's just been diagnosed with kidney disorder. Sure. So, we have to bury him the same day because he's Muslim. I just come back like 3 weeks earlier from the UK. And I just come home to spend time with him during the op. And that was it before I went off again. And so my whole world is turned upside down. And now my mom's been diagnosed with kidney disorder. And I remember thinking, wow, I actually felt relieved that he had passed away before she had to go through all that she had to go through. Because I couldn't imagine her having to take care of him going through what she went through. Yeah. Which was like the worst thing to think about. And I still maintain that my mother would never have been able to go, to take care of herself over that last 2 years if my dad had been alive. And as a daughter who loves her father, to think something like that is just the worst thing, I've gotten all of these ideas about Christianity from my mom, and I'm still very much a believer. But then to watch her, having to go through everything she went through in those last 2 years, and I'm like, but God, why would, from the time she was born, she struggled. Yeah. Why would you allow her in this last 2 years now to also go through that? But even during those times in a hospital, in the dialysis care center, she became an inspiration to so many other people. She became somebody who spoke to other, the doctor would call her to come and speak to other people around kidney disorder and stuff like that, which she loved doing because it's somehow, seeing out her little calling as a nurse and stuff like that. Even though she pronounced dialysis wrong every time. and I also felt responsible as somebody who, whose career had been derailed by speaking out against racism. I personally felt responsible for what my parents went through, because if I hadn't spoken about out against racism, then I would have had an academic position earlier in my life. And that moment when I went home, from the UK, the 3 weeks earlier, I went home, and when I opened up the fridge, there was only a jam and a butter in the fridge. And I remember like, just being devastated, sure. and my mother crying, and she's telling me, well, things got really bad, and we didn't want to stress you out, I was like, oh, let's go to the hospital. I mean, just go to the shopping mall. But going in the room and just crying my eyes out to think that here, look what my parents went through in their youth, and now at this age for them to be going through this. Yeah. So I go and I buy everything and I stock everything up, not knowing that I'm, buying and making things for my father, which is going to all be his last meals those 3 weeks.
No. My goodness.
And so, the regret that I have, the deep regret that I have, is that the few things that I wanted to do for my parents, like go on a trip with them to India and to give them a credit card in their hand that they could use without ever having to worry about stuff, to buy my dad a car, that didn't, so he didn't have to worry about something that broke down all the time. Those are the things that, the dreams you can never get back as a child. And I hear these messages Christian messages God will give you back everything that's been taken away from you. Like, actually, you can never give me back that. I live right now in a really beautiful house in Auckland Park, and since my parents died, I just see like blessing upon blessing upon blessing, because my mom, like when she got sick, she kept like, she was so upset at me because I refused to take out a life policy on her. And she's like, I have nothing to give you. I've never been able to give you everything you've gotten on your own. You've studied, you've worked hard. Please just do this. Take out a life policy on me so that you can get something in your life, and I can feel like I've given you something. And I was like, if you give me your blessing, that is all I want. I know that, because if I'm a Christian and I see that that has worked for other people in the Bible, that's all I'm taking away from you.
Yeah.
I'm stealing that from my elders. I'm dodgy like that. I swear, you know, and since my parents have died, I've just, you know, there's been one blessing after the other. And so I live in this amazing house in Auckland Park, and I have this amazing job and stuff. But there's nothing that can make up for not having done what I wanted for my parents, you know. So I live with that deep regret. But getting back to also that thing about, you know, forgetting as well, I think there's that's such an important point. You know, so I think when the moon waxes red, because my mom passed away 3 weeks before it opened in Durban.
Oh, wow.
And so it's fueled with a lot of that sadness. It's fueled with a lot of pain that I feel around a grandmother. She died when I was 4 years old, and I think a lot of you know, us as grandchildren feel like we wish she was alive, that we could have loved her and taken care of her. All of these women that we could never have saved. In a sense, even our own mum that we couldn't save. Like we ran out of time, because it just feels like just time was never on our side, because we were always struggling with our own lives as well, and our own battles. We just never got to do what we wanted to. You know, our working class life was just always just grabbing at our heels in a way. And I'm sure, you know, people who might be listening to that can sometimes relate to that. I don't know how you forget that, but I think forgetting is sometimes a very necessary part of that process.
Yeah.
Because I recognized it in myself, you know, when I was younger and I was chasing after those boys. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I realized is that, yeah, I had a great, one of these great Indian elephant memories, right? Which I never applied to my schoolwork. But when it came time to being in love, I could remember every single detail from the time I met the person, every single thing that they did or said, everything. I had like photographic memory, but applied to love. And the flip side of that was that when things didn't work out, those things would play over and over and over again in my mind. But they said this, but they did this, but. And I just couldn't let go. Years later, I would be wrapped up in that, like still in that moment, like feeling it still. And it was in a particular case with somebody that I fell in love with when I was 18, and in like 10 years later I was still in that, even when this person had moved on and married somebody else, and I realized, you know what, eventually I was like, in order to actually get over this, in order to let go, I had to forget.
Yeah.
And I had to forget everything. Like, I actually, in order to forget the bad, I had to even forget the good.
Good.
Yeah.
So I had to like stop thinking about the person in like entirety. And it was really sad because, you know, you don't want to forget the beautiful moments, you know? Yeah. You don't want to let go of that. But you got to let go.
Look at her.
Is she excited?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah?
And I had a lovely day, and you even see me later, and it was very good. Well, you were waiting for me, and then when I came back, you were smiling, and I was very happy. Then the time I got back, it was time for me to watch my iPad, then I could watch some of my llama, and then it was time for me to watch my iPad. Then it was time for me to eat my lunch, then my cookies, then my ice cream. Then I started boiling my dinosaurs, and that's the time I jumped off you. Mum, I think she's trying to say something.
Uh-oh.
Just to let you know, you'll make more responsibilities later.
I want to jump a little because of time. Mm. You are a mother too many. I know that. I've seen it. I've felt it. I really, for listeners, really got to know Charlene and her partner Fouad in the UK. Where I would, I was staying in a shithole town, and I would go to London, and Charlene, often it would be because Charlene would say, when are you coming? You need to come. You need to get out of that shithole town. I would go to their place.
And he would feed you. And that's also massive, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And Charlene and Fouad would, you know, I'd stay with them for a few days often. And I would then go back feeling I'd had an interaction with home.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Being home was my home. And so I have experienced how Charlene practices mothering care. I've experienced this myself. I'm not speaking about it as like, oh, I've watched this person do this thing in some kind of abstract way. And I've seen how much of yourself you give, Charlene. And I've also seen, which I think is also very much in line with how mothers pull shit out of hat, I've seen you more than I've seen most speak out, right? On things that, you know, that there's a kind of sexy around a topic, and Charlene will go for the jugular. I don't give a shit about sexy. Let me tell y'all. So, and I appreciate that. You know, I know I've certainly been very moved and inspired by that, both in speaking with you, hearing you speak, reading your work. Yeah, and so I guess I was hoping that we could spend a little bit of time speaking about how you see your own practice, if I can put it that way, of mothering. Not that I am suggesting that it is always a kind of consciousness, right? Because I think that we practice care. Sometimes we do it because that's how you are. You feel that's what you want to do. And other times it is an active, agential nurturing, right, that you go about in a very specific manner. And I was hoping you would speak a little bit about what some of your experiences have been, because you speak about you having had academic or art mothers, nurturers, carers, but you haven't spoken yet to how you actually do that yourself now. Not only now, but, you know, you have been doing that. And, so I was hoping you'd speak a little bit about that. So maybe I want to speak about that first, and then I have another question which I think leads off that.
In terms of, I've, you know, the because of I've, as I said, I've just had such amazing women in my life that has shown me that what the power of someone stepping in has done. It has just always felt like that's what you do. And tied up to Christian belief, you know, that you're supposed to give a tenth of everything you earn away, and that to whom much is given, much is expected. That has always been that. And, you know, my mother would do it just, this was part of her life philosophy, you know. When we would go to the Beta Street Clinic, when we're sitting in line, and we'd sit in line the whole day at the clinic, my mother would look at somebody else and she'd notice somebody who doesn't have anything to eat, and she would make us go and buy a Coke and a pie for that person. She would, from the stories that she told us about how she didn't have money to go on the excursion, and she would cry and tell us these stories. All of my nephews and my niece grew up, if there was somebody in their class who didn't have money to go on an excursion, they would come back and tell my sisters, and my sisters would then pay for children in their class and stuff like that. So we've grown up with the idea that this was part of who you are as a person, and that you were expected to do these things. It's not something extraordinary to give away, and that this is how you are expected to be and to do. And so mentorship comes from that. So because I've been given so much by the woman who stood in, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Sorry to break your word. As you were speaking now, I just had a question. Were you expected to, was there an expectation that you would have kids, or that some of this care was related to having children? So it's set up that way.
No, never. No. Never.
Growing up, I've become, I think, even more, like, some of these things have come back to me since having had a girl. The things that I'd be told, yeah. You know, growing up, like, girls need to know this, and, you know, as a girl, you should know this, because when you have, right, and the insinuation is when you have your children, and sometimes it's said, it's not only suggestive, that you will know how to. So, sorry, hence my question.
It's a great question. Because my sister fell pregnant at 16, and I was 12 at that time, it was actually the opposite.
Okay.
And I was the next person. It was,
yeah.
You will have nothing to do with boys from now on. You are not allowed near. My parents changed completely. It was like Fort Knox all around after that point. It was horrible. And so
it was
I also understood how devastating that was for my mother, and for the shame and all of that. So from 12 up until I was 13, there was no discussion around boys or babies or weddings or anything with me at all. It was different with my brother, who was 2 years younger than me. When he went to school and he came back with love bites, which is disgusting, on his neck.
They are disgusting.
Yeah. I
the other day. It's so gross. Oh. Okay, sorry.
There was these discussions with him, right? But or my mother would, but never with me. So it was, and then when I finally introduced them to Fuad, they simply introduced him to everyone as their son-in-law, even though Fuad and I have never gotten married. So I raised my two. So when my sister got pregnant and she moved off to Joburg, my mother and I started to raise her two children. And so from the time I was 12 to 26, I raised these two kids with my mother. And by the time I was 26, I was hurtful.
Yeah.
I had enough. It was like my whole childhood went away. I was tired. And at the age of 25, I remember, because at 5 o'clock, I would have to wake up I would have to get the kids ready for school, you know. I would have to iron my clothes and my brother's clothes and my father's clothes. I would have to sweep the house and clean it and everything, you know, because everything's left to my mother. Come back from university, a long day at university, attend to the children with the schoolwork, give them a bath, attend to their reading and everything, then do my own university work. You know, and one of my nephews, and in a few years you'll recognize this, but one of my nephews, he hated schoolwork, he hated reading. He would take like half an hour to get to the bathroom, he'd drag his feet, he'd take like 20 minutes to drink a glass of water, then he'll go into the toilet. The next thing that you'll hear, there's a stump on the roof because now he's taking toilet paper and making it into wet balls and throwing it on the roof.
Oh my goodness.
No way.
He hated schoolwork. And so I would get so angry. And the other one, you know, who I could terrorize, was younger. But this one just hated stuff. And I remember being 25 and I was so tired this one day. And I was hitting the older one. And I realized as a child was crying and not responding to anything that I was actually hitting him because I was just tired. I wasn't because I was angry at him. I was just hitting him because I was tired. And I looked at this kid's face and I was like, you know what? I'm not going to hit this kid anymore. I'm not going to do this anymore. If all of these adults want to behave like this, I'm not going to do this. People can look after their own child.
Yeah.
I've lost my whole, all of my teenage years. I'm going to move out of this house and I'm going to, I don't care what happens to these kids. I'm sorry what's going to happen, but I need to move right now.
Yeah.
And that was it. And then I made this decision that if I ever chose to have kids, I'm going to have my car, my house in place. I'm going to have my doctorate in place. I'm going to have all of those things. So I'm never going to be tired again. And I'm never going to hit a kid again in that way.
Sure.
And then by the time I had all of those things in place, I'm over 40. It became difficult. And it is what it is. And
right.
I don't, it's not like I sit and I go, oh, I'm so sad about it and I'm so sad it didn't happen. I still have this very jarring visual picture of what it was like to raise two kids.
Yeah.
And how exhausting it was. And yeah, there's also this thing about, oh, I remember how cute they were. And when I see my granddaughter and everything, I'm like, oh, she's so cute. Yeah, you can have her back now, which it is. So getting back to the whole mentorship thing, you know, it's always just been a part of the whole trajectory. You know, it's a matter of you have so much, you know how difficult it can be. You simply have to do this, right? It just always feels like a very natural part. I don't always think I'm gracious in it. Like, there's a number of students that, and I have to say, there's a number of white students, for instance, like I've mentored, and they will use things that I've said, they will use things that I've done and stuff. And they will just not credit you back. Sure. They will even use stuff that like your words verbatim, and they just won't give you credit.
No.
And
that's
yeah, and it's like, but part of Black feminist history and lineage is to pay homage to that lineage, to show the kinds of works, because you know what it's like not to be acknowledged, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to be erased out of those histories, And you know, and male students also do this a lot as well.
Mm.
Like they've just come up with all of this stuff by themselves. They just came to know about the Black feminist killjoy because walking down the road, they just tripped over this thing by themselves, you know?
Yep.
They've just come across radical negativity having sat on the toilet that morning. So I think that's, you know, that you know, we talk about genealogies and you know, there's a whole history of feminist genealogies that have been given, whether we're reading of these genealogies in books, and people have been mothering us through their works. Bell Hooks may not have had children. Audre Lorde, I don't know if she's had children or not, but think of how many people they have mothered that they will never meet. How many of us have come through to healthy spaces and who are healthy versions of ourselves because of having encountered a Bell Hooks book?
Absolutely.
Having encountered Toni Morrison, absolutely, having encountered Sarah Ahmed, you know? So for me, it is very important to call up somebody and say, you know, come over, have something to eat, come over, let's meet. I do care about you. I don't always get it right, you know, because between having a full-time job, which I need, making artwork, which is what I'm really about, but I don't get a chance to do that on a full-time basis, having to write articles, which again is not something I want to do, but life has shown me that my voice is necessary, and so I have to write. Between doing things like the conferences and the reading groups and all of that, it takes a lot of energy. And sometimes I don't get the time to sometimes just sit down and go, hey, how are you? There's also the flip side to that, in that there's people who take. So sometimes, like a few weeks ago, somebody, sent me an email, and they're like, here's a body of work I'm producing. Give me feedback. I haven't heard from this person in 4 years.
The next day,
they called me up and said, did you get my email? No, how are you?
Hi, how are you? Are you well?
Yeah, nothing like that. Like, they haven't spoke, but like, you know, they just want something from you, like literally. And I'm not exaggerating for the sake of this talk. Literally, I picked up this phone. Hi, did you get my email? I'm like, we haven't spoken in 4 years. And so, you know, there is that flip side to mentorship, where people don't feed into you, where they don't water into you. And so I'm also very cautious, because last year I was diagnosed with fibromyalgia, which is the brain's inability to deal with trauma, with pain, and that's something that came out of all the trauma in my life. When I'm really in struggling with pain, and I'm really struggling with fatigue, which is the real issue sometimes I struggle with, I have to take time to take care of myself, which I try to do. And so there's a limit on what I can do and what projects I can take on. And so there's things I have to like say, no, I can't do this now. I really have to take this weekend off. I really have to take this week off. I have to sometimes just say, no, I can't write your text. I just can't do this right now. And people get really, really upset. There's really sometimes lack of understanding and really little care, because people are desperate for mentors. They really are. So I take that role very, very seriously, of course. I always think that, you know, the mentors that I have, I feel like I always need to invest in them as well. It always has to be a back and forward with all the people that we have.
Yeah. What? What? Mm-hmm. What are you asking for? Use your words.
Mama, is this art?
That is art, love. Are you eating, Amo? Up. Up. Finish your food. I'm quite enthralled. I think that's why I'm so quiet, Charlene, around your capability around telling stories. And the sense that I get or your storytelling capability, the sense that I get is that it's like a generational thing. So I can almost imagine, as you said, your mom telling you stories and where that kind of came from, the story around your grandmother making handmaking lace, right? But I just find it incredible that, and often, more often than not, it's women that really hold that space for the family and in a way stitch together a narrative of what a family looks like and what it means. And in so much of that process, there is remembering and forgetting, as you say, right, around what we choose to omit and what we choose to tell our children. And I find I think that that's something for me that I have been thinking a lot about, and how that plays into your daily mothering practice, whatever that looks like, with your children or with the people around you who you mother, but also what that looks like in the long game. So how a child becomes an adult who then, how do they identify themselves in the world, what is their position within the world? And I'm not talking about it from a political point of view or whatever. I'm currently on a course called Umama Wetu, where we're looking at social justice and like a kind of indigenous knowledge and care and ritual and practice. And what was interesting is that we had the first session this past the Wednesday past, and the initial kind of session was just to introduce oneself, and two or three people introduce themselves within a broader context of like, I am the daughter of, and then not just the name, but also what that looks like. And we know that we've come across people like that in South Africa who do that. That's a very indigenous way of being in the world, but it isn't the modernized way of being in the world where you kind of are your, I'm really not being articulate, but like thinking through your bio, you had two bios, right? The first bio, the formal bio, the one that you kind of show to the rest of the world, is yourself, where you speak about your achievements and like that kind of a thing. And it's kind of, it can be read almost in isolation, even though you realize that it's in within community that you're able to do those things, right? But it's not explicit in that particular bio. The second bio is a lot more informal, and actually you do speak about yourself relationally, even if it's implied. And I just think I'm starting to just spend a lot more time thinking through the role that mothers play in literally the fabric of our lives, like putting together the textiles of who we are, in terms of the storytelling narrative. So that's very lengthy and tangential, but that's kind of what I've been thinking about a lot since you've been talking.
I mean, that's a really beautiful question, Kathleen. I think we all are repositories of stories, you know. Every single person. It's just you know, with cultural dominance, some people's stories are given more credence than other people's stories. What I found with like this work around When the Moon Waxes Red is that, I don't know if you remember when we were in Cape Town for Becky Peterson's conference, where I was doing the keynote. But when you know, people asked me like these academic questions afterwards and this like that, and then after the room emptied, there was somebody who was the cleaner, and she came to me afterwards and like with tears in her eyes, and she said to me, "Thank you for that, and you must keep doing the work that you're doing."
Wow.
And I was like, yeah, you know, this means more to me than the room full of people I just spoke to, you know. Because all of those academic questions are great, but this means something to this person in the same way that I made it. And I find that even sometimes, you know, people may not have the words for it, but they connect on that level, that I'm going through something and you made a work that speaks to me. And that's the power of creativity, I think, that it sometimes we use words, sometimes we use visuality, sometimes we use music, sometimes we use dance or movement, sometimes we just even use silence and we just sit together, and all of that is the, you know, human ability to communicate and to feel like we are, in, you know, connected, and that we identify with each other. Mm. And in a world that's so fractured, you know, I think that's what we're always needing to be reminded, that regardless of all the various identity politics, and I'm somebody deeply invested in identity politics, sometimes we do need to be reminded that we are fundamentally one, right? And we are one group of human beings, and not only that, we are a group of people that need the actual space that we are on. We need to be in touch with Earth that we are on. We are not going to find our space out there on Mars and Jupiter and the moon. We've got this incredible, beautiful planet that we are here on. And that's what we need to sustain ourselves, each other, and this incredible planet.
Mm.
And I think that's, you know, that's the community I grew up with. You know, it wasn't just women that passed on, and I think women are incredibly central to telling stories and passing on this wealth of information to do this work. But in the community that I grew up in, men were equally as wonderful storytellers.
Mm.
So they would sit every time the lights went out, and the lights used to go out a lot in those days. We would sit around, bolas, fires made in drums, and all the horror stories and the stories around graves and Highway Sheila, which is a ghost who used to haunt this one highway with so all of these stories. And I love those things. And so it used to be incredibly fascinating, all of these stories that we kind of grew up with around the community of a woman who committed suicide and left her 2-month-old child, and then used to come and haunt that whole road as she cried for her child. So it used to be incredibly fascinating, the way people used to tell stories in those days. I just feel like I missed out on a cultural moment because of my youth, that I wasn't able to understand the value of those stories.
Mm.
So even that last week, the last few weeks before my dad died, I came back and I was so tired, having completed that PhD in 3 years. He kept sitting with me and telling me all of these stories about his youth and stuff like that. Mm. And I was like, I don't know why he's doing this. And I was like, this is really good stuff, but I was too tired to even press play on my, you know, record on my cell phone. And I just didn't understand that here was, and we have this belief in our community that before somebody dies, they try to tell you their stories.
Oh, wow.
And again, I just wasn't sensitive to the moment.
Sure.
Sure. Wow. Yo. Wow. Yo, Charlene, I feel like we could literally just keep speaking. I
also feel that way. And I must admit, like, normally I'm super chatty, but I've literally just, I feel transfixed actually with the way that you tell stories. And feel incredibly grateful to be on the receiving end of them. And it's such a remarkable thing. It actually also, in a way, kind of makes me feel like, it's strange that you said, Dee, that like after seeing Charlene, you would go home and feel like you had had, or go back to the shithole and feel like you had had a moment to be at home, right? Because it transports me to home in the sense of like, going back to KwaZulu-Natal and sitting around the dinner table with my grandmother and my aunts and uncles, and all of them, as you say, being these incredible storytellers. It also makes me ask the question, Charlene, and maybe this is not linked to motherhood at all, or mothering or whatever, but you said people used to tell incredible stories in those days. And obviously what you're implying is that it's less so now. And is that indeed what you're saying? And if that's the case, what do you think that shift has been attributed to?
I shouldn't say that. I think there's something particular in my family, for instance. So a lot of my mother's generation has passed away, and so there's this yawning gap in my family where a lot of us who are younger, we don't bond in the way that my mother's family does. We don't get together in the way that they did, because it was like a huge break in the family, since the death of one of us. And so I don't believe that has fallen away, because I think in communities across the world, you'll find that they are great storytellers, that people still bond in those kinds of ways. So I think this is a particular
personal, familial,
and I think also sometimes sort of younger generation who didn't grow up with particular community settings might also, storytelling never dies off. If you look at The Lord of the Rings as a movie, or, you know, all of those things, storytelling keeps evolving. People don't sit through 6 hours of movies because they don't, you know, there's no storytelling anymore, because people, you know, people absolutely love stories. By the way, talking about being at home, I can never see Dee's parents, because Dee's parents remind me so much of my mom and dad that every time I see them, I start bawling my eyes out.
When she sees my dad in particular, it's actually really creepy. I was like, what is going on here?
Can I say, actually, that Dee actually, so Dee made mention of your work before in a previous episode, and she said as much. She said it was super weird for her that every time you see her dad, you start bawling.
Yeah, her dad's kind of got that huge belly and like that my dad had.
Yeah.
And so, I'm quite skinny, but I have a huge personality.
Yeah.
So it takes a huge kind of person to kind of comfort me and hold me, and my dad was a huge person, and so I kind of, you know, when I met Dee's dad, he reminded me of that, and I just bawled, because you know you will never find that again, and so it's like. I remember once when I lost exam papers. as academics, you realize how terrible this is. That, you know, the exam papers had been sent. They went off to the moderator. They came back. Now I'm supposed to administer the papers, and I lost them. And I was in a department where I was stepping in for someone, and they disliked me intently. I don't know why. And so I remember now I have to go and tell them that I've lost the exam papers. And my dad drove me that day to the department, and I was just like sitting outside, and my dad says to me, just remember something. Your father isn't dead. And I looked at him and I said, yes. And I walked out. And as I'm walking up the stairs, I read the kind of dualistic meaning in that, right? You know, between my dad and like father in heaven kind of thing. And I felt rather brave about that. Like, yes, of course. You know, I always have my home. My dad is there. I don't have anybody in the world to fear, you know, between Father in heaven and my own dad, who's basically the most terrifying person on earth, that I literally have nobody to fear. And so, I mean, it was hilarious, because I went and I said to them, I lost the exam papers. They asked me questions. I sat there and never answered them. It was the most bizarre thing, as people tried to ask me questions and I answered nothing. And we can see how chatty I am. And I never answered anything. I just stayed quiet the entire time, because I said, well, the papers were lost. I had to reset the questions. I had to call this person who was on leave from leave. She's the nicest person on earth. She tried to ask me questions. I also didn't answer them. completely weird. That again, that was over, I don't know, 20 years ago. She's still so nice and friendly and is a friend. And so, you know, so I'm not somebody who, you know, having now lost my father, there is no home to go to, having established myself as my own person. But so when I see Dee's father and mother, it's like they remind me of home and a space that I will always miss, like till the day that I die. And I think like, okay, you know, when I was younger, I had all these things of what heaven might be. Heaven is a place you get into if you're good and if you're this and if you're that. And now heaven is just like, maybe heaven is a place where we just the best versions of ourselves, and hopefully like my dad is there waiting with his big belly out, and when I approach there, he's just waiting to give me one of those big bear hugs, and I know my mom will be peeking out from behind him. Aww. And she'll say that the mutton curry is ready.
I was gonna say she'll feed you.
So that's my idea of heaven now.
Wow, Charlene, thank you. Wow, I don't even know how to close this.
So let's close with thanking the two of you for like these really wonderful, honest conversations, because I think it's fantastic what both of you are doing. You both are really incredible in terms of your own scholarship, but just giving so much of meatiness to these kinds of ideas, right? And how we think about these things.
Thank you so much, Charlene.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. This has been such an incredible episode. Yeah, thank you very much. I've actually sent Dee a side message saying, okay, I'm officially a fan, and when can we all have dinner? So we'll have a conversation about that, or we'll just stalk you, or I'll come up to your beautiful house in Auckland Park and I'll need to come and see it for myself.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Thanks, Charlene. Have a good evening.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Bye.
Hey, I'm Kathleen.
And I'm Dee.
And you're listening to Mamas with Attitude, otherwise known as MWA.
Mama. Attitude.
The same way I immerse myself in my career.
Yeah.
You've now immersed yourself in motherhood.
I've now immersed myself in motherhood.
Mama's a bounce.
So weird. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, motherhood just comes to take on its different shapes and form.
Mama.
No, actually, seriously, on a serious note, it's been really dope.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Mama. Attitude.